Roosevelt is a common name in the pantheon of American presidents. You've heard of Teddy Roosevelt, of course, and Franklin Roosevelt, and of course, Eleanor Roosevelt. One name that might not be quite as familiar to you is Kermit Roosevelt, but I promise you it's a name that's very common within the Roosevelt family over the generations. And I recently spoke to one of the more recent ones. He actually goes by Kim. He's got a very interesting job. He's a professor at my alma mater at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. I didn't have him. He's actually a bit younger than I am. But that's not why we're talking to him today, or at least not specifically. Today, we're speaking with Kim Roosevelt because he's a novelist, and he's written a very constitutional novel. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly constitutional, and this week it's about allegiance.
Welcome to your weekly constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris and produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
I've spoken with today's guest before. His name is Kermit Roosevelt. He goes by Kim, and he's a professor of constitutional law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Some years ago, we spoke about what was then his new book, The Myth of Judicial Activism. That was an interesting discussion, and it was all about that strange term, judicial activism. If you're interested, go ahead and Google it or find it on iTunes. It was a good episode. But recently, I got an email from Kim, and he was telling me about a different book that he's just published, a very different book. In fact, it's a novel. And you might think that's sort of odd for a law professor to be writing a novel, but it happens from time to time. And this one, well, it makes a great deal of sense because it's about a very constitutional subject. It's about a subject that we've talked about on this show many a time, the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II without any semblance of due process of law. Like the Broadway play of the same name, this one is called Allegiance.
My name is Kermit Roosevelt, and I teach constitutional law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School.
I have heard of that place, and rumor has it that it's the very best law school in the world.
I certainly wouldn't argue with that.
Absolutely not, and it's particularly noted for the prominence of its graduates and how they go forth and do wonderful things in the world.
They are certainly making the world a better place this morning.
Indeed they are, and some of them even have their own public radio shows, but I get ahead of myself. So Penn is a marvelous place. We love Penn. I'm so very pleased to speak to you. We've spoken once before. Do you remember? We talked about your book, The Myth of Judicial Activism, some years ago.
I do remember. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, that was a great discussion. Judicial activism is one of those terms that always gets bandied about, and we devoted a whole episode to it, which is available on iTunes now if anyone wants to listen to it. But that's not what we're going to talk about today. Today we're going to talk about your secret identity. You're a law professor by day, but then you put on a different costume and do your superhero thing by night.
I thought you were going to say superhero, but actually it's not a superhero. My secret identity, and I don't want it to be too much of a secret, that's why I go on radio shows, but my secret identity is as a novelist.
That is just a remarkable combination. Tell me a little bit about that. You've got two novels out now, and in a minute we'll talk about the current one, but you actually wrote your first one, what, about 10 years ago?
It came out just about exactly 10 years ago.
What was that one about?
That one was about law firm life. It was about associates and partners in a large law firm. It was set mostly in Washington, D.C., and it was about the ethical and professional challenges that lawyers face, the different kinds of cases they work on, the different kinds of issues they have to deal with.
In the Shadow of the Law, I think, was the title, wasn't it?
Yes.
In fact, you won some awards for that, and I think that's still available, isn't it?
It is.
A lot of that comes through in your current novel as well, the conflicts that lawyers face, so I can certainly see a continuity there. You're a professor of law, you teach the coolest subject, constitutional law, at the coolest law school in the country, what prompted you to take on the additional burden of writing fiction?
Well, writing fiction is something that I've actually always been interested in. From my high school days, I started out writing short stories in high school. I started writing novel-length fiction in college. It took me 12 years after I started, I guess, to get the first novel published. But then I've never really stopped. I've always been doing it. The subject has changed a bit. So, you know, as I learned more about law and the legal system and constitutional law and the Supreme Court, I started writing more about those topics and less about my autobiographical escapades, which is probably good. good for me and the readers.
I think probably most novelists start out that way, don't they? Talking about some poor, misunderstood fellow who bears a remarkable resemblance to the author.
Exactly.
Exactly, I understand. Well, that's really cool, and it's obviously a marvelous avocation to have, or a second profession, I suppose. But let's talk about your current novel. What's this one called?
This one is called Allegiance, and it's a little bit of a departure for me in that it's historical fiction. So it's set not in the present day, but during World War II. And its focus is on the Supreme Court in World War II, Supreme Court cases about the rights of Japanese Americans, mm-hmm. and the Japanese American internment program.
Now, there's a subject that is strangely and tragically timely, and we'll get to that later. But I should mention it's a topic that we've discussed several times on this show. Some years back, I interviewed Karen Korematsu at the Korematsu Center, and I've interviewed Barbara Takei about Tule Lake. And we recently just did an episode on a visit that I took with my son Tom out to Manzanar. So this has been definitely something that I know I've been interested in, and many of our listeners have been interested in. And again, all those episodes are available on iTunes now. But what prompted you to write about this subject?
Well, it's sort of a long story, but what happened was my editor, the editor from my first novel, told me that he wanted the second one to be set in the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And I said that that's...
I'm going to pause there, Kim, if I may interrupt you, because you are being very modest, but you've got unusual credentials in that regard. I believe you clerked for Justice Souter, didn't you?
Yes. Yes, I did clerk for Justice Souter.
Okay. So that's probably what prompted, I'm just guessing, your editor's suggestion that you write about the Supreme Court, because you were an insider there for some period of time.
Yes. And actually, that was the source of my hesitation, mm-hmm. because the Supreme Court's a very important institution. It's fascinating. I thought that I would like to write about it, but I didn't want people thinking that I was revealing secrets about the justices that I had learned during my clerkship with Justice Souter.
Well, I have to interrupt you again then, Kim, because, of course, and I have a little bit of understanding of that, too, because when I was at Penn back in the 80s, everybody had a copy of a book called The Brethren, which is based upon journalist Bob Woodward's interviews with current and former Supreme Court clerks. I think that was the genesis of the concern that the clerks might spill the beans. Was that in your mind when it was part of your hesitation?
Yes, that was part of it. And more generally, I just thought that I had been given a great opportunity and a wonderful experience that year at the court, and it would not be very kind of me to repay that by revealing secrets. So I wanted to avoid even the suspicion of that.
Right.
But that would make it very hard, I thought, to write about the Supreme Court in the present day, or even, as my editor then suggested, in the future. Because even if I invented new justices, people would assume that, to a certain extent, they were based on actual justices.
Right.
So I was talking to my wife about this terrible, insoluble problem. And she said, well, why don't you set the novel in the past? And that struck me as a brilliant idea, because mm-hmm. then I wouldn't have to invent nine new justices, and people wouldn't think that I was using fictional characters as stand-ins for actual justices, because I could use actual justices, but I could just research them.
Mm-hmm.
And also, setting the book in the past would let me look back through Supreme Court history for an era and a set of cases that had some relevance to the present day. And that was the other thing that I was trying to achieve. I was trying to write a book that said something about what's going on in America now.
And when were you thinking all these thoughts? What year were you tossing these ideas around and coming up with your concept?
Well, the funny thing is, and I'll get back to this a bit later maybe, but the funny thing is this was back in 2007. It took me 8 years to write this book.
Mm.
So I started looking for historical parallels to the present day back in 2007.
And of course, that was the post 9/11 era.
Yes, what I was thinking about then was the reaction to September 11th. And maybe in particular Guantanamo detention, because I had just recently started working as a constitutional law consultant on a Guantanamo case, and I had visited Guantanamo Bay, and it made a very strong impression on me.
Mm-hmm.
I learned more and more about what the government had done to keep me safe. And I wanted to write something about what the government does in times of national insecurity and national fear, and the reasons behind that.
And did that drive you back to the early military tribunal cases, like the German saboteur cases?
Yes, I actually had about 20,000 words on the German saboteurs and that case in my early drafts of this novel. I ended up trimming that way, way down because I thought that it diluted the focus and I wanted the plot to move a little bit faster. I wanted it to be more concentrated on the Japanese-American cases, which are the main focus.
Right, and before we leave that, I'll just mention for those who are not familiar with it, there were actually some saboteurs. They did come over from Germany. I think they were let off both on Long Island and on the beach off of Jacksonville, Florida. And they brought with them nasty things like weapons and explosives. And they were, fortunately, they were all caught very quickly. And then they were ultimately tried, and they were tried not in Article III courts, but they were tried before military tribunals, and there was an entire appeal all the way to the Supreme Court, and ultimately that procedure was blessed by the court, and that was a very important precedent in all this discussion about Guantanamo. In fact, what was the major case there? I forget, it's off the tip of my tongue.
The Guantanamo case or the
the military tribunal case from the 40s.
The tribunal case from the 40s is called Ex Parte Curin.
Right, Curin. Excuse me, I couldn't remember it off the top of my head. So that was a great premise too. I could see why you'd spend 20,000 words on that, because that would be a really cool thing to write about. But ultimately, you decided that the Japanese so-called internment cases were more interesting to you.
Well, they connected more to the main themes of the book, and they helped me move the plot along more.
Mm-hmm. And the plot, I should mention here, involves not only the Supreme Court, not only the Japanese-American cases, but a murder. And how did you decide to do that? I mean, this could have been just sort of straight literary or commercial fiction that didn't actually involve anybody being killed, but simply involved the larger legal themes. Why did you decide to include a murder in your plot?
It could have been a much more historically centered book. And in fact, in the early draft, it was.
Mm-hmm.
I did a lot of research about the Japanese-American cases and the German saboteurs and the detention program and life in the camps. And my first draft had really only essentially historically accurate material in it. But then my editor said to me, this is fascinating background material, but it would be good to have a plot that will really grab the reader and drag him or her along. And after kicking a couple of ideas around, then we decided we'd do a murder mystery.
Mm-hmm.
And I resented that a bit at the beginning because I thought I had this historically accurate book about very significant events and deep themes and constitutional questions, the nature of American identity and loyalty and allegiance. And now I was tarting it up with this thriller, murder mystery, conspiracy plot.
Mm-hmm.
But I ended up actually thinking that it was a good idea, in part because it does make the narrative move a little bit faster and it makes it a little bit more gripping.
Mm-hmm.
But also because the great virtue of fiction is that you can tell the story you want to tell in order to illuminate the themes that you want to illuminate. And what I did with the thriller plot was to try to investigate the same themes that are raised by these historical materials. So what does it mean to be an American? Mm-hmm. Who can you trust? How do you know who you can trust? And maybe most centrally, when is it okay to sacrifice some people in order to save others? And I get at those questions in one way through the historical materials. I get at them in another way through the murder mystery conspiracy thriller plot. And I hope that those two aspects of the book cast light back and forth on each other so that it ends up being much richer than it would have been if it was purely fiction or purely history.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Professor of Law Kermit Roosevelt about his new novel. It's called Allegiance, and it's about the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and we'll come back and speak some more with Kim Roosevelt. So stick around. Thank you. And now it's time for me and my buddy John Alger, the president of James Madison University, to share a constitutional quiz with you. Okay.
Very good.
Who's this guy?
My name is Matt Mueller. I'm a junior international affairs and political science double major, and I'm from Manassas, Virginia.
From Manassas, Virginia. That's a fine place.
Yeah.
They had a battle there.
Yeah, we had two battles there.
Two? You're well. Okay, Mr. Smarty Pants. Okay. Quiz Press, give him a hard one. He's a smart guy.
Okay, so a little bit of history here. This should be easy for you, given what you've already demonstrated. So we've been talking about the Philadelphia Convention, right? Which of the following individuals was not at the Philadelphia Convention? A, George Washington. B, James Madison. C, Thomas Jefferson. Or D, Alexander Hamilton.
I'm going to assume that James Madison was, being
okay,
that he wrote
that's
part
a gimme.
I think I'm going to lean towards A, George Washington.
George Washington was not at the Constitutional Convention.
I don't think he was. At the end of the Revolution, he wanted to get out of politics, but they called him back to be the first president.
Okay, what are the other choices, just to make sure we go?
The other choices, we'll take Madison out of the mix. I think we've pretty much established he was pretty busy there, right? A was George Washington, C was Thomas Jefferson, and D was Alexander Hamilton.
So those three, you're thinking George was hanging out at home.
Yeah, I think Thomas Jefferson, because he was one of the lead anti-Federalists, was there. I think that Alexander Hamilton was there because he was one of the lead Federalists.
Final answer?
I'm going to have to go with A.
Quiz Prez?
And the correct answer is C.
Oh,
really?
Thomas Jefferson.
Sorry, Matt.
It's fine. There we go.
We're sorry, but you know, this is a very important question in a couple of respects. First of all, Bill Wilson and President Alger wanted to have at least one question in here where we could diss Thomas Jefferson. And so we're very happy to do that. Absolutely, yes, absolutely. Okay. Yeah. No, seriously, Thomas Jefferson was busy over in France at the time, and though he and Madison corresponded, they're very, very close friends, they really were BFFs, they corresponded, and definitely Jefferson demonstrated some sort of delayed influence, especially during ratification, especially with regard to the Bill of Rights. He was not in the mix, and when letters are taking a month or 6 weeks to get across the ocean, that's very, very important. And that's, seriously, one of the reasons that I think Madison is unjustly overlooked is when I compare him to somebody like Jefferson. Jefferson's a great guy. He did great things. You know, he had his issues too, but he did great. You know, Declaration of Independence, all men are created equal, fabulous, great writer, looked great in knee breeches. But he did not participate in the more important document, which was the Constitution. The other important thing to say is that George Washington not only was there, if he'd not been there, probably the whole thing would have failed, because he was the rock star of 18th century America. He was the reason people came, and Madison persuaded him to come. Very important subplot in the whole constitutional scheme.
And just a reminder of why Madison ought to get more credit.
Much
right,
more
in
credit.
In Virginia and in the United States.
Much more. We're working on that.
We are.
And we named a university after.
We did.
We did, okay. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm in the middle of a delightful conversation with Kermit Roosevelt, a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania, who's written a novel. It's called Allegiance, and it's about the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II. But it's about more than that, too. It's also about the Supreme Court, how the Supreme Court functions, the importance of the law clerks, and even a murder mystery. Before the break, Kim was telling me, oh, he goes by Kim, by the way. Before the break, Kim was telling me that how he combined and why he combined straight historical fiction with a thriller plot.
No, I'm actually going to congratulate you in that regard. I think you and your editor made a very good choice in that regard because, you know, you and I, and I'm sure most people who are listening to our conversation are very, very focused on constitutional law. We find this historical period both dark and fascinating, but a wider audience might not be, at least initially, quite as interested. And as you say, you need to move the plot along. You've got to give the reader something. I think Stephen King refers to it as the gotta. I gotta know what happens next.
Yeah.
And although if you go too far with that, yeah, you could be tarting it up. But on the other hand, you know, a book is not particularly valuable if nobody reads it. And so I think that sort of artistic compromise was very well done. In fact, I'd give you a very high compliment. Your style of writing, using a first-person narrative and having a murder as the basic plot moving point, reminds me actually of the early novels of Scott Turow. Did you ever read Presumed Innocent?
I did. I loved Presumed Innocent.
Yeah, I thought that was very well done, and even the subsequent books that he had involving the same characters. And Scott Turow is a fellow who's always been very interested in literary fiction, and I think he thinks of himself in that way, but he's also obviously very, very commercial, and I thought he did a very good balancing act in Presumed Innocent and some of his subsequent books. So that's high praise. I think you've accomplished much.
Thank you.
Oh, absolutely.
I take it as such.
Yes, it's very, very well done. But let's actually talk about the book then now. Now, we're obviously not going to give away any major plot points, and we're certainly not going to give away the ending, but who are the main characters? And let's set this story up so people can think about whether they want to read it.
The central character is a guy from Philadelphia. His name is Cash Harrison, and he's in law school when the Pearl Harbor attack occurs. He wants to join the military. He wants to serve. He wants to do the right thing, but he fails the physical. Then he gets, apparently, another chance to serve in a different way. He gets a chance to clerk for Justice Hugo Black at the Supreme Court. And he's clerking at the Supreme Court during the first of these Japanese-American cases, the case about the curfew that was imposed on Japanese-Americans on the West Coast. Mm-hmm. After his clerkship ends, it's a one-year clerkship, he stays in Washington,
D.C. Was that the Hirabayashi case?
Yes.
Okay, that's right. Okay. Okay, please.
He stays in D.C., and he gets a job working for the Justice Department. And he gets assigned to the Alien Enemies Control Unit. And he ends up being charged with writing the briefs in the Korematsu case, the case about the exclusion orders. Mm-hmm. So he's now the person who's supposed to be presenting the government's case to the Supreme Court. He's supposed to be defending this exclusion and detention program.
But what I meant, Kim, when I said before that I thought there was a strong element of the conflicts that lawyers feel. Because I don't think it's giving away too much to say that Cash is not particularly enamored of this entire program, but he's charged with defending it.
Right.
So how does he...
He's trying to figure out what the right thing is. His motivation as a character is supposed to be pretty simple. He wants to do the right thing, but he's in a situation where it's hard to figure out what that is. He's got conflicting duties. He's got conflicting loyalties. And so he's struggling to find his way through this pretty complicated moral and ethical maze.
And he does so very, very well, or I should say he does so in a very entertaining and illuminating way. The portrait that you paint of Hugo Black I found particularly interesting along the way. He, of course, was a Southerner. He was from Alabama originally, I believe, and he was even a member of the Klan in his youth.
He was, yeah.
But then he became perhaps the most ardent supporter of civil rights for that era, and had some interesting personality quirks. He was a tennis player who basically was looking for a partner when he chose Cash to be his clerk. I mean, certainly he wanted a good fellow on the court, but that relationship was very, very well painted. Is that based, again, upon your research or upon your experience about the sort of relationships that clerks have with their justices?
It's based on both. Mm-hmm. I did an enormous amount of research about Hugo Black because mm-hmm. he's a big figure in the book, and I wanted to get that right. So I read several biographies. I read a memoir that his son had written. I read accounts that clerks had written about their clerkships with him. So I based a lot of it on that research. It's also informed, of course, by my experience clerking. I had very close and warm relationships with both of the judges for whom I clerked. And then actually, in a sort of interesting twist, Hugo Black's tennis game, I could reconstruct a little bit from the books that I read, but to the extent that I couldn't, the experience of playing tennis with him is based in part on my own experience of playing tennis with Justice Scalia.
Justice Scalia and you played tennis?
Yes.
You clerked for Souter, didn't you?
I clerked for Souter, but Justice Scalia would regularly play tennis with his clerks. Mm-hmm. And one week, the clerk he played with had twisted an ankle playing basketball, and so they were looking for a substitute, and I volunteered. I thought it was a great opportunity. So I did play tennis once with Justice Scalia.
But David Souter is known as one of the more liberal justices, and of course Scalia is the arch conservative, so I suppose tennis knows no partisanship?
Well, I tried to take the opportunity to talk to Justice Scalia about some of the cases. I didn't make much headway with him.
Oh, he just wanted to play tennis?
Yeah, I think he was looking for a tennis game rather than an airing of my constitutional views.
I see. Well, you got to give it a try, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so Cash has that wonderful experience with Hugo Black. Very illuminating, very interesting. He's a great liberal and a civil libertarian. He also encounters at the court another fascinating fellow, a titan of that era, Justice Frankfurter. And I think Justice Frankfurter really embodies what you were talking about before when you talk about allegiance and identity as a German-Jewish immigrant. Could you talk a little bit about him and his role on the court and how that's reflected in your narrative?
Frankfurter is a very interesting justice. It was expected when he came to the court that he would become a leader because he was a brilliant professor. He had great, great intellectual ability. But he ended up, on the whole, alienating the other justices. He was not very well liked, in part because he was condescending, in part because he was very manipulative.
Wait a minute. A law professor being manipulative and condescending? I mean, that seems so unusual.
Well, maybe it's an argument for appointing people who haven't been law professors.
I see. But at any rate, he was, you mentioned not only the Korematsu case, not only the Hirabayashi case, some of the other Japanese cases, but you also mentioned the Pledge of Allegiance cases, and he played a really important role. There were two major cases. I wonder if we could talk a little bit about those two cases and the role that Justice Frankfurter played.
Sure. So the Supreme Court heard two cases within a very short period of time about public schools requiring children to salute the flag and recite the Pledge of Allegiance. Mm-hmm. And in the first of those cases, the Supreme Court said it's okay.
That was the Minersville case, right?
Yes.
Okay, and that was out of West Virginia. And the facts were basically, though I'm going to skim over some details, that you had a couple of Jehovah's Witness students who didn't want to recite the pledge because it violated their religious beliefs. But at the same time, they were not only required to attend school, but they were required to recite the pledge. And when they were disciplined for having done so, it went all the way to the Supreme Court, and it was Justice Frankfurter, the immigrant, who blessed that procedure, who said that that was within the Constitution. And why would he do that? Why would he allow a public school to force a child to pledge allegiance to this symbol?
Basically, two reasons, I think. One is, Frankfurter really did have a consistent judicial philosophy, which was judicial restraint. So he envisioned a pretty small role for the courts. He thought most issues, you leave it up to the ordinary democratic process. Mm-hmm. The courts are not going to come in and tell the government it can't do things, except in a very extraordinary case. And when he was appointed, that was generally a liberal philosophy because you had the liberal FDR government doing things that liberals liked, and the judges who would stop the government from doing something were the bad conservatives. Later on, the ideological valence of that judicial restraint philosophy shifted, so it came to be seen as more conservative in cases like the flag salute case. But I give Frankfurter credit for actually being principled in his views about judicial restraint. The other thing, though, was patriotism. Mm-hmm. So war was on the horizon. Frankfurter loved America. He was very patriotic. He wanted to say something about national unity and symbols and how we live by the flag and how important it was that we were bound together by these symbols. So it's also an expression of his patriotism.
And that, I think, goes to his identity, because the way I've always heard it, though my research on Justice Frankfurter is no doubt not as extensive as yours, is that he sort of fit the classic immigrant pattern, that a combination of profound gratitude for what he'd been able to experience here in the United States, for the country taking him in, plus a desire to prove himself as not an outsider, but rather as part of the in-group, led him to defend at least the orthodoxies of the in-group. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, I think that's very accurate.
Yeah, and that's true of a lot of immigrants. And that, of course, ties back into your basic theme about allegiance. Now, just to finish the thought, Frankfurter was reversed very shortly thereafter in a second pledge case, wasn't he?
Yes. So the reaction to the first pledge case was not what the court had been hoping for. Generally, it was taken as a statement that if patriotism means saluting the flag, the witnesses are not patriotic. There was a strong backlash against the Jehovah's Witnesses. Some of their kingdom halls were burned. They were attacked by mobs. And the Supreme Court, or at least some of the justices, realized this is not at all what we wanted to do. We didn't want to draw a line between real Americans and people who are not real Americans and suggest that the witnesses are not real Americans. You know, that's sort of exactly the opposite of what the case was supposed to be about. It was supposed to be about bringing America together. And here it turned out that they had set us apart. And they received a lot of public criticism. Eleanor Roosevelt was a critic of the decision. So several justices, Hugo Black among them, changed their minds. And the next time the case came up, the next time the issue came up, the court went the other way. And in an opinion by Justice Jackson...
Wait, before you get there, because that's one of my favorite lines, but this was also out of West Virginia. It also involved Jehovah's Witnesses. In fact, it was almost a replay of the earlier case. And what was the name of the second case?
It's West Virginia Board of Education against Barnett.
Barnett, the Barnett case. And this is one of the ones that I always enjoy discussing every spring when we get to it in my constitutional law class. So Justice Jackson, Robert Jackson, one of the best stylists on the court, at least in my opinion. Yeah, I just love reading his stuff. What did he say when the court reversed itself and said that the state can no longer compel these students to recite the pledge?
Well, he had a number of wonderful phrases in that opinion. I'm not going to get them exactly right, I think. But he said, compulsory unification of opinion achieves only the unanimity of the graveyard.
Yeah.
He said, if there's any fixed star in our constitutional constellation, it is that no official, high or petty, may force a confession of faith or dictate what shall be orthodox in matters of politics.
I believe you nailed that. That's my recollection, too. I don't have the quote right here in front of me, but those are stirring words. No official, high or petty, can tell us what we have to believe. And that really sort of struck me as being the essence of the First Amendment, both the free speech clauses and the religion clauses. It just really kind of nailed it. That's what it's all about, really. It's not just about expression. It's not just about free exercise. It's about ultimately preserving the ability to think as we believe we should.
I think that's absolutely right, yeah.
Yeah, very inspiring words. Okay, so that ties into it too. So this is happening at the same time. In fact, I believe the Barnett case was actually on the docket the year that your fictional Cash, Cash Harrison, is on the court. It's mentioned in passing.
It's mentioned a couple of times.
Yeah.
And for a couple of reasons. I mean, one is it's about this question of allegiance. Mm-hmm. Another is the two different perspectives that the court takes on it show you this way in which very patriotic people can differ about how best to serve the Constitution, how best to promote the country's interests. And also, it has a sort of interesting counterpoint to what was going on with the Japanese Americans at the same time the court was deciding this case. Mm-hmm. Because at the very moment the court was saying school children cannot be required to recite the Pledge of Allegiance, the U.S. government was administering a loyalty questionnaire to the Japanese and Japanese Americans in these relocation camps and asking them, would they forswear allegiance to the Emperor of Japan? Would they pledge allegiance to the United States? Would they express a willingness to serve in the U.S. military? And if they said no, it was sending them to a special segregation center for disloyals.
Right, at Tule Lake, which I've spoken to Barbara Decay about in the past. And yeah, in fact, the way the questionnaire was set up, it was actually two questions, one of them specifically about, you know, who are you loyal to? Are you loyal to us? The second one, would you be willing to serve if called upon to do that? And those who answered those questions with no's were, in common parlance, called no-no's. And it was those no-nos who then pretty much automatically got shipped off to Tule Lake. and sort of formed the hard core of resistance. The popular image of the Japanese incarcerations is that the Japanese sort of meekly went along with this, and that's certainly true for many. They made a reasoned decision that the best way for them to prove their loyalty was to not resist and to volunteer, and many of them did, and we've talked about the 442nd, and we've talked about the heroism of the people involved in that, and the irony that we're simultaneously putting people behind bars and drafting them into the military. But that wasn't the whole story. The part of the story that you really focus on and where you actually send your fictional character out to is this place where Thule Lake, where people who didn't act that way, the Japanese Americans who resisted, resided. And those were some of the more compelling scenes, I thought.
Well, thank you. I thought that Thule Lake was a particularly fascinating setting for a number of reasons. One is the role of the loyalty questionnaire really dramatizes these questions of allegiance. The other is that over and over again, the government was trying to figure out who was loyal and who wasn't. And the loyalty questionnaire was an initial attempt at this, but it didn't work very well because many of the people who said no did not say that out of disloyalty. Some of them were confused. They thought that the question asking if they were willing to forswear loyalty to the Emperor of Japan was a trick, that if they said yes to that, they were admitting that they had in the past been loyal to Japan. And then some of the people to whom this questionnaire was given were Japanese citizens, so they actually should have been loyal to the Emperor of Japan. And if they forswore that loyalty and pledged allegiance to the United States, that would be treason.
Yeah, it would be.
Yeah.
And so interestingly enough, that many of them who were Japanese citizens because they had been prohibited from becoming American citizens.
Yes.
They had been immigrants from Japan, and our very restrictive immigration laws had said, well, you can come here and stay here and work here, but you cannot actually become a citizen. So it was only their children who, through the 14th Amendment's birthright citizenship provision, became citizens, and I believe those were called the Nisei.
The Nisei, yes, the second generation.
The second generation, and then there's another term in your book that I've discussed before, the Issei, and those were actually the third generation, right?
Or the Issei are the first generation.
Excuse me, I got to get it mixed up there. Okay, the Issei were the people who came and were not allowed to become citizens. And yes. So to the extent that there were Japanese citizens who were put in a quandary by these loyalty questions, they were Japanese citizens only because they'd not been allowed to become American citizens. Many of them probably would have done so if given the opportunity.
Yes, yes. Probably most of them would have liked to become U.S. citizens.
My, my. So here they are in this camp. They're being asked these questions that are very, very difficult to answer. People giving the no-no answers for a variety of reasons. Some of them certainly just very, very angry about their treatment and sort of reacting very, very negatively to it, to the point where they're actually professing loyalty to Japan now. In fact, that was one of the more gripping scenes, is when Cash shows up at the Thule Lake internment camp, and there are people outside sporting the Rising Sun insignia on headbands and marching around and chanting their loyalty to Japan.
Yes. A number of them did. So there was a significant faction, particularly in Thule Lake. They called themselves the Hoshidan.
Right. That's a term I had not encountered before, the Hoshidan. Okay.
Yes. And they were loyal to Japan.
Now, was that something that pre-existed their incarceration, or was that something that was a reaction to their maltreatment?
I think it was largely a reaction to their maltreatment.
Mm-hmm.
It's the sort of reaction that you have, I think, when this figure that you have loved and trusted betrays you.
Mm-hmm.
So within the Japanese American community before Pearl Harbor, there would be arguments between the older generation and the younger generation, you know, the immigrants who were not allowed to become citizens, and then their children who were very proud of their U.S. citizenship, very patriotic. And you know, the older generation would say to them, your citizenship actually doesn't mean that much. Americans still think of you as Japanese. And the younger generation would say, no, the Constitution makes me a citizen. I have all the rights of a U.S. citizen. Then, you know, those rights are taken away. They're put in a camp. Unsurprisingly, I think a lot of them reacted with hostility and anger to that.
Yeah, and the key word there, of course, is betrayal. And I think to bring it to something that many people can understand a little bit more personally. It's the same sort of thing of in a marriage. And, you know, if you're betrayed by your spouse, that's a terrible, painful, horrible thing. And then you have to make a decision how you're going to react. Are you going to try to preserve the marriage? Are you going to try to get along? Are you going to try to accept what's happened and try to patch things up? Or are you going to decide that, I can betray my spouse too, or I can get a divorce and I can decide that I hate this person. So just as there's a wide range of reactions to that sort of more personal betrayal, I guess that happened within the Japanese American community as well.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with novelist and constitutional law professor Kermit Roosevelt about his newest novel. It's called Allegiance, and it's about the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II. After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and then we'll come back and finish our conversation with Kermit. So please stay with us.
L'amour réduit à la raison. Love reduced to reason. In an upstairs bedchamber at Montpelier, this is the title of a print of Cupid chained to a statue of Minerva. Venus stands behind to the right of Cupid and has confiscated his bow and arrows. Cupid in Roman mythology was a mischievous god, and when he shot you with his arrows, you'd be overcome with uncontrollable desire. In Stoic Roman times, falling in love was an irrational act. That meant you were giving in to your passion rather than relying on reason. In this print to show Cupid tough love, Venus, the goddess of love and beauty, has taken away his tools and chained him to Minerva, the goddess of wisdom. While perhaps it's not appropriate for a bedroom, it's a perfect choice in artwork for Madison, always so concerned about the passions of the people, and who believed that if men were angels, no government would be necessary. With the Madison Minute, I'm Jen Patia-Hell.
And now it's time to finish our conversation with Kermit Roosevelt, all about his new novel. It's called Allegiance, and it's about the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II. And one of the things we were talking about just before the break was how, you know, there were 100,000, more than 100,000 Japanese Americans and people of Japanese descent who were caught up in this. And there was a wide range of reactions. It was, in many sense, a betrayal. Many of these people felt betrayed by their own country, and there was a wide range of reactions to that as well.
It did. And, you know, that's sort of the central choice that's dramatized in the George Takei musical Allegiance. Mm-hmm. So there are two characters there. One of them wants to volunteer to prove his loyalty to serve in the U.S. military. The other one is drafted and wants to resist that, thinks that this is true patriotism, standing up for his rights. And actually, you know, now that I think of it, Cash faces kind of the same choice, mm-hmm. because he's patriotic. He wants to serve. He wants to do the right thing. He discovers that what his government is doing is maybe not the right thing. And then he has to decide, what is his response to that discovery going to be? Is it going to be obedience to the government? Is he going to go along with what they're doing, even though he has doubts about it? Or is he going to try to pursue what he believes is right?
Yes, indeed. And I'm reluctant to talk too much more about Cash because we've already gotten fairly deep into the plot, and I don't want to spoil it for anybody. I'll simply say that with this sort of setup and these sorts of conflicts and this sort of constitutional background, this sounds like a perfect book for listeners to this radio show. So I'm going to urge them to go out and get one, get 5 or 10 of them and give them to friends for Christmas time, because it is available out there. But before we leave your book or leave the subject entirely, you've already mentioned George Takei's musical that just recently opened on Broadway of exactly the same name. And you acknowledge this similarity in your publication materials. Give me the backstory here. Was there some sort of coordination going on here? Did the two of you talk to each other, or was this just coincidence that you both picked the same name for your works of art?
It was just coincidence. Mm-hmm. I like to think that there are ideas that are out there in the air. You know, two different people invented the steamship at mm-hmm. the same time, and Newton and Leibniz came up with calculus. simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a time now, and the themes that we're both addressing are they're just sort of in the air, and the title Allegiance is a very good way to get at that. Because mm-hmm. the fundamental question really is, where do you place your allegiance? What does it mean to be loyal?
Especially when you've been betrayed. All right, then. Before we leave that, I just have to ask, have you seen the play? Have you met George?
I have seen the play. I went to see it a couple of weeks ago. I loved it. I urge everyone who's listening to go see it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get a chance to stick around afterwards and try to meet George, but I do have an event with him coming up January 25th in New York at the Japan Society.
Well, please give him my regards and tell him I've been a fan of his for the last 50 years, ever since he was Mr. Sulu on the original Star Trek, which, by the way, is the best Star Trek series. We can all agree on that, I'm sure.
I'm with you there. Yes.
Absolutely.
What makes a man?
Allegiance, now playing at the Long Acre Theater. We welcome George Takei, the actor whose life inspired this musical. George, what is the story of your life that inspired this musical?
Well, I grew up in two U.S. internment camps. I was 5 years old at the time that the soldiers came to our home in Los Angeles, and literally at bayoneted gunpoint, we were ordered out of our home.
And this was 1942, right?
1942, yes. You know, my experience is that of a child from 5 to 8 and a half, totally different from that of my parents. We were innocent American citizens. My mother was born in Sacramento, California. Mm. My father was a San Franciscan. The kids were born in Los Angeles. And yet, because of our race, we were rounded up and imprisoned. And it was the most egregious violation of the Constitution because there were no charges. They took everything from us. My father says, they took my business, they took our home, they took our freedom.
To them, I'm just a number on a beat-up luggage tag. A nameless, faceless body in a crowd.
All right, well then, before we leave this discussion, let's go back to where we started. I mean, you were obviously inspired by post-9/11 events to write this book to begin with. Do you see any relevance to this book, given what's happened in the intervening 7 years and, you know, perhaps what's happening even as we speak?
I do. And it's sort of amazing that I started writing this book 8 years ago, thinking about what was happening in 2007, and it's happening again now. There's a lot of people looking back to the Japanese-American incarceration. But in another sense, it's not surprising, because the very reason that I thought I could write a book about World War II that would have relevance for 2007 was that there is this pattern, this cycle that occurs repeatedly in American history, which is basically that something scares us, something like a sudden unexpected attack, and we react, we try to make ourselves safe, we overreact, we usually commit injustices. We injure innocent people in an effort to make ourselves safe, even though frequently what we do doesn't make ourselves safer. And then we regret it. We say that we won't do it again. We say that next time we'll be better. And I think actually, if you look at history, we are getting better, but we're not all the way there. We certainly feel the same things. We react in much the same way. And so I think it's a lesson whose relevance is really never going to go away. We've got to be on guard against this fear-inspired overreaction that leads us to think that people who are merely different from us are actually dangerous, and that it's okay to mistreat them in the name of national security.
Yeah, and as you point out, not only, of course, does that trample on people's civil liberties, not only does that create very serious moral issues, but it can backfire, because when people are betrayed, they can themselves react very negatively, just as some of those people at the Tule Lake camp reacted. And so if you paint with too broad a brush, no matter which group is being targeted, you can end up creating more enemies for yourself.
Yes. I think that's a very good point. And the parallel to the Hoshidan is both instructive and in some ways alarming, because it clearly does go to show, if you treat your citizens badly, if you treat them as though they're enemies, you can make them into enemies.
Very, very concerning. We're not political on this show. We're not partisan. So I'll mention that a Democratic mayor of the city of Roanoke in Virginia recently made comments about Muslim Americans and about Muslims coming in from overseas that seemed to favorably reference the Japanese American incarcerations of the 1940s, and he was roundly condemned for it. And then the Republican presidential nomination, he's not the nominee, a fellow
not
who's
yet.
Not yet. He's certainly the front runner. Mr. Trump has made a number of statements that have similarly drawn parallels between the Japanese American incarcerations of the 1940s and seemed, at least upon first reading, to express a support for that as a reasonable response to today's threat. So you seem to have hit the timeliness nail on the head.
Well, like I said, I think, you know, it was timely in 1944, timely in 2007, timely again now. It will keep happening.
Well, let me shift focus just slightly before I let you go. Of course, listeners could not have helped but notice your very famous name. It's actually Kermit Roosevelt, which is a recurring name within your family tree. And I simply note that not only you are the great-grandson of Teddy Roosevelt, but you are a distant relation of Franklin Roosevelt, who I must say, Kim, does not come off very well in your novel.
Well, this was certainly not his finest hour.
Right.
I think that Franklin Roosevelt was a great president. I think he was a good man. I think he had more empathy than might have been expected from someone of his social class and background at the time. But clearly with the Japanese Americans, he failed.
So this is not just revenge by the Oyster Bay branch of the Roosevelts against the Hudson Valley branch.
No, people have asked me that. No, not at all. That sort of rivalry.
To coin a phrase, no.
That rivalry is much overstated.
Right, I understand.
I don't think there's hostility between the branches.
Understood. Well, I'm also a great admirer of your distant relation, both of your distant relations. And so thank you very much for sharing your perspectives with us. Thank you very much for writing this very, very interesting and compelling bit of fiction. And before we go, any final thoughts?
If I wanted to boil all this down to a simple message, I would say what we can do to avoid committing the same kind of mistakes in the future that we have committed in the past is to develop empathy, to understand that all of the people out there, even if they're different from us, are humans whose interests should be counted, should be taken into account when we're making our policy decisions. And what this requires, for lack of a better word, is empathy. And the only thing that I know of that has been shown in experimental conditions in laboratories to actually develop empathy is reading novels. So my prescription for the future is we all need to read more novels.
And preferably your novels.
Well, we could start with mine, but I've only got two. So after that, you know, feel free to move on to others.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Kermit Roosevelt. I've been calling him Kim because that's what he goes by. Kermit Roosevelt, who's talked to us about his really remarkable novel, Allegiance. It's a thriller and a murder mystery, and it's also a lot of very interesting historical stuff about the Japanese-American incarcerations of World War II. I highly, highly recommend it. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. Our Madison Minute is by Jen Patia Howell of the Center for the Constitution at Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harrison. Remember, you are a part of the American experiment.